certified as a federal lab for diagnostic reasons, for animal health purposes and disease control. And they've passed with flying colors, except they testified that the folks that were looking at them said that they didn't believe there was enough public commitment to the lab. Now, I don't know what that means exactly, but to them it meant that we're too fee-driven and not enough general fund-driven into that account. And they're asking for 1.25 to show the public commitment. Now, I don't know if that's 600,000 or 500 or 300 or 200 or what shows public commitment, but I trust you'll work with their staff and others to ascertain that. And frankly, they should just make the commitment and not lose a federally certified lab. And I don't know what's going on over there, but I think it's kind of an internal thing, and best you sort it out.
Is there anybody from the university that wants to just come down and tell us what's going on to help out Representative Johnke? Welcome to the committee, sir, and just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Trevor Ames. I'm the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine.
Could you say your name again?
Trevor Ames.
Thank you, Mr. Ames. Go ahead.
So I appreciate the opportunity to talk before the committee. The planned use of the $1.25 million, if appropriated, is to support the critical lab function and service functions of rapid disease detection and emergency response to protect the safe health and well-being. Inadequate support for the diagnostic lab threatens not only the economic vitality of Minnesota's animal agriculture industry, but also compromises safeguards for public health. Every year, the diagnostic lab runs millions of tests that support decision-making by the producers in the state of Minnesota, the veterinarians in the state of Minnesota surrounding what they're going to do with their animals. In addition, the diagnostic lab is the official laboratory for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, and it runs thousands of tests supporting the functions of the Board of Animal Health as well. It also supports the Department of Health and the Department of Agriculture with testing, as well as the Department of Natural Resources with testing for things like chronic wasting disease, tuberculosis in deer, and even viral hemorrhagic septicemia in freshwater fish. I think maybe a good example of the emergency response capacity of the diagnostic lab could be illustrated by last year, when there was the disease affecting the pork plant workers in Austin, Minnesota, and that disease condition was designated as progressive inflammatory neuropathy. The diagnostic lab worked with the Minnesota Department of Health to test samples from over 200 people to determine that they were not being affected by diseases from swine. And so, thankfully, they showed that that was not the case, but that was an example of how they were able to respond in a rapid, accurate fashion. So, specifically to respond to the issue of accreditation, the American Association of Veterinary Laboratory Diagnosticians goes through a review process, an accreditation review of the diagnostic lab, and they ensure the quality of service that it provides to the state agencies and the animal agriculture of the state. And in their recent review, they found that the level of state support was too low to give full accreditation, so they only gave 1 year of accreditation rather than customary 5 years of accreditation. They found no major other significant deficiencies with the diagnostic lab, and they will be back in December to review this accreditation issue. I've brought Dr. Jim Collins, who's the director of the diagnostic lab, and perhaps he can specifically address this issue of accreditation and state support to specifically follow up on what Representative Johnke was talking about.
Welcome to committee, sir. Just identify yourself.
Again, this is
quickly tell us what's going on.
Jim Collins, the director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. The amount of funding for the diagnostic laboratory has not kept pace with the need, and so we've become increasingly reliant on user fees. And so the laboratory is now 80% self-supporting. And the accreditation committee feels that that's out of balance, because if we operate as a business, we will not be meeting the needs of the public and serving the public good, because we'll be making decisions more based on possible revenue income as opposed to protecting human and animal health. And so that is what the accreditation committee is concerned about.
And so what would the accreditation committee, which I assume is a national committee, what would they be happy with as a mix of dollars?
Well, they look at peer institutions. So with peer institutions for us would include labs like Michigan State, Purdue, Iowa State. And so to bring us up to the next bottom level of those peer institutions, I think it would take the full $1.25
million. So let me ask a real dumb question here. But so if, you know, you're charging the DNR and the other folks that are coming, and so if you took that money and gave it back to the University of Minnesota, then they gave you public money to the, you know, to the president's office or wherever, to the lobbyist's office, whomever, then would you meet the mix of dollars?
Mr. Chairman, city members, the original goal, the laboratory has been in existence since 1904. There was no user fee imposed at all until the mid-70s. After that time, the original goal was to be 75% public supported, 25% user fee supported to pay for your direct costs. Obviously, as times have changed, most laboratories are shooting for a 50-50 public-private relationship. And so that is the goal that is being strived for. Right now, it's out of balance with 80% user fee and 20% public support.
Questions? Representative Acton.
Chair, to what extent are your users public entities?
Mr. Collins?
Be they DNR, any sort of public or municipal or whomever.
Right. The bulk of our testing and work is for animal agriculture and is private farmer paid. Only a small percentage of our revenue is derived from other state agencies.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? If not, then we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Junkie, and you might as well stay up there because you have another bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. We'll see what we can do, and maybe Ms. Peterson has some ideas for me. Maybe we can use federal stimulus money, for instance. Representative Junkie, House File 1813 has been referred to us because of the elevator issue. So why don't you tell us what you're trying to do and then maybe what happened.
Nothing about love in an elevator, Mr. Chair. It's something else. But Representative Mahoney requested this down for good reason. I had a bill on man lifts in grain elevators, which is the basis of this bill.
I thought I've educated you as your roommate. People lift.
People lift.
Yes.
Man lifts. Okay, we're on the farm. Sorry about that to some members of the committee. So anyway, the bill that I had some agreements drawn up. It put out a ways the need for them to go through the inspection process until Dolly reported back on and did a little study work. Well, Representative Hamilton then attached an amendment for churches and their elevator inspection. Small churches in particular that pay these large $3,000-$4,000 fees annually to Dolly and can't afford it. He exempted them. They had to register the elevator but not pay the inspection fees. Again, I think what Chairman Mahoney wants to do, and rightly so, is maybe redraft some language to look at all these elevator situations, have them come back next year and make it part of your omnibus bill, perhaps, Mr. Chair, that language. I'm happy to let Representative Mahoney work on that.
Members, first, I think because I didn't have a quorum, and I do now, Representative Poppy moved House Bill 839 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. And all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, that motion prevails. Excuse me. Now we're on to House File 1813. Representative Mahoney has moved, and Representative Mahoney, then after that explanation, you offer the A3 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am often...
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, I inadvertently, I think the amendment had some unintended consequences. Has the exception to nonprofit entities under the 501c3 title exempted somewhere between 4,000, 5,000, or 6,000 elevators. We're not entirely positive, but we know it's at least 3,000 or 4,000. And these are everything from 3-foot high lifts to 30-story tall nonprofit apartment buildings. That's not appropriate. As Representative Junkie said, we're going to. I'm working with Dolly, right, the Department of Labor and Industry, right now. They're going to try and come up with some way to study this and come back and give us a little bit better idea. I've talked to Representative Hamilton. He's not thrilled, but he understands that we can't exempt all these nonprofits from inspections. We call the department down. I think it's about $100 a year is the registration, and the inspection right now is like once every 5 years. But that having been said, we'll be back next year with something that deals with this a little bit more clearly and really does try to carve out and help small churches that can't afford this. But if we take this language off, Mr. Chair, I think we can send this bill right back to the House floor, and then it'll match up with the Senate language,
and where we'll see probably the amendment again. But that's the members. Are there any questions? I think it is a safety issue, and Representative Mahoney, what you probably can do prior to this bill being heard on the floor is get an idea of how many there actually are, and you've given us a frightening description of exempting 30-story elevators. But is there a way to meet Representative Hamilton's concern about the, you know, I know there's a half, you know, one that just goes down 4 feet and goes very slowly in our church up on the north side of Virginia, and I'm sure they could maybe have a different fee structure in that. So if you could work with Dolly before, then we can try to solve it.
Mr. Chair, we're trying.
So we've got the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails, and Representative Mahoney moves in that House File 1813 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Rights. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, Representative Otremba and Representative Atkins move House File 1447 be recommended to pass and hold it.
Yes.
And held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Otremba, my understanding is this is a pretty popular idea, and there's not really any opposition to it. In fact, it's necessary. So if you could quickly give us an overview. Welcome.
Thank you. You want the students first? Should we get cut down?
We'll take, Representative Sam, just a brief description. It's a, you know, student loan buy-down program, right?
Well, student loan forgiveness for veterinarians.
And we have a student that wants to testify, so we'll take the student, Dean. You don't mind that, do you? Okay, welcome to the committee, ma'am.
Well,
just state your name for the record.
Sure, Amber Hegel. And first of all, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee today for hearing us. This is a very important issue for me and the rest of my comrades at the University of Minnesota, especially for those of us who are food animal orientated. Currently within the state of Minnesota, there is a significant shortage of food animal veterinarians. And when I say that, I mean veterinarians who serve beef, dairy, poultry, and swine. And this is a very important issue, not only for producers and animal agriculture, but also for foreign animal disease surveillance, as well as just the public health issue in general. This piece of legislation is very important because it allows food animal veterinarians to serve those underprivileged areas, and otherwise those food animal veterinarians may not be able to afford to do so. So if this piece of legislation is passed and gets through, it could be very significant for us, and I would urge you to take a significant look at it. It's very important to me and to the rest of my first their class, and when they heard that I was coming today, they were like, oh, let us know how it goes. They're very excited. So so I would very much urge you to consider the Chiefs legislation.
Well, Amber, you touched my heartstrings when you said you and the rest of your comrades, you know, so I have to, you know.
Glad I could do that.
But, Dean, can you tell us what kind of numbers do we graduate at the veterinary school, and how many is this going to help?
So we have 90 students a year that graduate.
In the large?
No, in large animal, we are probably lucky if we have 10 to 15 students a year, and that's a significant decline. That's very much driven by the explosion in sort of the veterinarians going into companion animal practice. So there are higher pay structures, starting salaries for veterinarians working with small animals, and that's very much affecting the profession and the decisions that are being made by our graduating students. So we put a lot of thought and effort into how to attract more students. We've got an early admission decision program in conjunction with the College of Agriculture. We've got some very unique education programs, so we have the best training. Really, this would be the capstone on that, so that rural students that come into our program and that are interested in working in rural areas have the training and the expertise so that they could succeed in serving those rural areas. Now they could financially afford to do that. So the bill would fund about 5 students a year, so it would enhance the ability of 5 students a year to go into these areas. In addition, we also have scholarships. We have a growing number of scholarships that are directed towards students interested in specializing in food animals, so this would be in addition to that.
Okay. Any further questions then? If not, then thank you very much for your testimony, Representative LaCrema. We'll hold it over for possible inclusion in the bill. Amber, thank you very much. You tell our comrades that we'll try to do what we can. Okay. Representative Downey, do you mind if I move Representative Kahn up just quickly? I don't think her bill's going to take that long. Representative Kahn, Representative Atkins probably wants to move this bill to help Representative Kahn along.
Probably.
Move. Representative Atkins moves House File 817 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. Representative Kahn? Or would you want it to go on its own, or how?
I think we just vote.
Recommended to pass and move to the general register, but could possibly show up.
Yeah, okay. I have to explain everything about why this is will really work and how good it is, and is a best phrase if I'm Secretary of State.
Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State, and this is one of our proposals. I believe it's coming to your committee primarily because of the first section of the bill, which makes some changes to the student housing list that are available on election day as an option for same-day registration for college students around the state. And do you want me to just talk about fiscal?
No, you can. We're okay. Both the policy.
Okay.
So just a little touch on the policy part of it.
So for many years, most colleges have provided lists of students who live on campus, and it's been a statutory option for colleges to provide lists of students that live within 10 miles of the campus, but most have chosen not to do that, in part because it's hard to figure out who lives within 10 miles of the campus. It's easier to know who's on campus or off campus. It's also, you know, where do you measure from? Where does the 10 miles start? A few places that have had off-campus students on the list haven't had a way to precinct the list. So they've had to compile the whole list and make copies and send it to every precinct in the 10-mile radius, which is extra copying, it's extra cumbersome for the election judges. So what this does is it requires MNSCU, requests that the University of Minnesota, and allows other colleges to provide a list of all of their students residing within Minnesota to our office. Our office would then precinct the list and send it to the county so that then just the appropriate names could be sent to the precinct so that it can be used in combination with a student's photo ID for purposes of election day registration. This does not register students to vote. It just gives them an option to prove their residence if they do election day registration.
Is there any opposition as well?
No, we've worked with private colleges and MNCU and the U to address all their concerns, and they've been addressed in this bill.
Any questions from the committee? Representative McClellan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what would stop a student from doing an absentee ballot in their home district and doing a same day registration? I mean, I know it's against the law, but what would be the safeguard?
Mr. Chair, Representative McClellan, there isn't. A student could do that, and occasionally students do. There were a couple of students at St. Thomas University in 2004 who thought it would be fun to send in an absentee ballot and vote in person at their school on election day. They were, I believe, convicted of felonies. One of them wanted to be an attorney, and his, you know, dreams went down the drain. So there's a very steep penalty for choosing to do that. And these lists are already in the polling places. It's just expanding who's on the list.
Any further questions? If not, then Representative Atkins removes his motion that House Bill 817 be recommended to pass and we refer to the Senate Register. And all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Fine. Representative Downey moves House Bill 1194 be recommended to pass and held over. Representative Downey for possible inclusion. Or no, we're referring this to taxes. Excuse me. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Be recommended pass and re-referred to the tax committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess maybe officially I'll move House File 1194 to pass and be referred on to the Committee on Taxes. Just a couple words of introduction, and then I'd like to have Mark Loftus actually at a very high level walk through the three programs that are outlined in this bill. And then we do have an individual, Chuck Hayes, who's the Vice President of Sage Electrochronics, who would provide some testimony to how his benefit actually, or how his business actually benefited from the previous Jobs V program, similar to what we're proposing here. So a quick overview, if I could, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Loftus. This bill is actually a part of the governor's overall balanced budget proposal. As you're aware, incentivizing business growth and job creation is a prominent feature of his bill. So I am asking this committee to look at this from the workforce development job creation component and as a courtesy pass it on so it can be fully heard in the Committee on Taxes, where a more vigorous discussion will proceed on the merits of the tax relief provisions in here. I'd also note that Representative Winkler actually carried a similar bill that I signed on to for the small business investment tax credit portion of this bill. So this is actually, I think, in some ways, at least components of it are supported on a bipartisan basis, and I've been glad to join in on those efforts. So briefly, if I could, just in terms of an introduction, there's a handout that talks about bridging the valley of death, and the heading is just an eye grabber. That's not really death involved here. But what I wanted to point out was that
there could be if you keep talking.
These tax credits are part of a broader strategy to invigorate job growth and business creation in the state of Minnesota. And I think a lot of folks don't understand what it takes to really launch a successful business, let alone maybe support an entire industry sector. And while medical devices and some of the other technology sectors that we've been very strong in Minnesota for a long time have a lot of kind of institutional support, there's knowledgeable venture capital, there's the university, there's a lot of skilled people, there's plants and facilities, there's know-how. In the green sector and in the energy, the clean energy sector, a lot of that doesn't exist. So if you look at this chart, what I'm trying to convey here, actually this is from somebody else's presentation, but every stage you go through in developing a company requires certain things to be deployed in order for it to succeed. And you can see those elements down the left-hand column of the page, just what I was talking about, all of the things that need to be in place for a business to succeed. And so these tax credits are designed to support that one component of business formation, which is the availability of credit and capital at the front end of a business's growth. And I wanted to give you a couple of examples, if you wouldn't mind turning the page to the Drafts Corporation overview slide. Drafts is a business that actually exists out in Representative Anderson's district, an early-stage biomass company that is attempting to bring to market a set of products that would replace benzene in the productions of various fibers and plastics, and do so using biomass and biofuel components. So we would have the ability to replace our dependence on oil for the production of these plastics. And if you look at the size of that market, 100 billion pound annual market, and that's about $100 billion annual market for these kind of products that go into the production of these kind of plastics and fibers. This is a huge business opportunity. This is a business that has a price point for its products that is competitive, maybe very competitive on the market. They've just raised a round of venture capital, and they're looking to determine whether to site their pilot lab in Michigan or Minnesota. So the ability for Minnesota to compete for that and to help this business grow and take it to the next level of its development here in Minnesota is exactly what these programs are geared towards. They have 23 employees in Minnesota and 8 in Michigan, and it would be a shame if we lost their actual production capacity to another state. The next page talks about another company, SoftScope, which is a med device company here in Minnesota. I won't say where. They're developing a product that would actually do an upper GI scope as compared to current technology, which is limited only to the lower GI. So a very important advance in terms of endoscopic technology. And I would draw your attention to the comments at the bottom of this, or on the second page, talking about Minnesota being an attractive state to launch new med tech companies, but we have a tax structure and an access to capital that at this point is starting to inhibit even the formation of med tech companies in spite of our strength there. So these bills are designed to kind of fill that gap where companies need early stage capital of various types, make sure that we help them, launch them, and grow them here in Minnesota and hold on to those jobs in these very important emerging sectors of clean energy and green technologies. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Loftus to run through very quickly the bill and the specific tax credit provisions in it.
Mr. Loftus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. You have, in this committee, you're considering three articles in this bill that that give us the tools that Representative Downey described to help early stage and growing companies in green tech specifically, but also technology companies more generally. So Article 1 contains our tax exemptions that are similar to the original Jobs Z program, corporate income tax, sales tax on construction and purchase of materials, and also local property tax. It is similar in some ways to the original Jobs Z, but as we've drafted the legislation, it has, our department has specific oversight and approval of all projects, as we now do with the original Jobs Z. And we have a system of measuring the return on investment of proposed projects. So we have responded to the legislative auditor's report from last year, Mr. Chairman, and incorporated those elements into this to give us a tool to help compete for companies that are trying to grow here. Articles 2 and 3 are both tax credit proposals. Article 2 is a small business tax credit. It is a mechanism for insurance companies to invest in companies that we would certify that would then in turn use those funds and invest in qualified businesses. And that is a mechanism that is in place in about a dozen other states. Some of our own Minnesota insurance companies have use that in other states where there is that credit or that exemption against their premium tax, which is due in that state. So we'd like to have those Minnesota companies be able to invest in Minnesota in a similar mechanism. And as you see, we've identified that it would be at least 50% would have to go to green technology companies, and the others would be to other kinds of tech businesses. And Article 3 is the job growth tax credit, the so-called angel tax credits for maybe smaller investments. that is a total of $12 million over 4 years, and would it would also help us collect smaller amounts of funds from smaller individual investors that would be would go into earlier stage companies perhaps than Article II companies would. But it's another part of that, the Valley of Death that Representative Downey described, to help us invest, help individuals in Minnesota invest in early stage companies that some of our neighboring states have done. And we have, as structured, these proposals are the cost of these credits are deferred out until the first credit could be taken in the year 2012. And we think that, that even at that, that will still reduce that investment to occur in both Articles 2 and Article 3. So that's a very quick summary of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Sir, welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Hayes. I'm a vice president at Sage Electrochromics in Faribault, Minnesota. As means of introduction to Sage, Sage manufactures the green, clean, new energy conservation technology that's called electrochromic glass. This electronically tintable glass technology allows you to tint and clear glass in a building or a home on demand, not just for the glare control you get with lenses, but more importantly, our technology allows you to control the solar heat gain coming into the building. The United States Department of Energy testing at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab showed that the Sage technology out of Faribault, installed and integrated with the lighting and heating and ventilation systems in a building, would save the average commercial building over 40% on its total energy consumption. When you consider that commercial buildings are over 40% of the total energy that is consumed in the United States, all sources, this single technology here in Minnesota could make a material step toward national energy independence. Sage did not incubate here in Minnesota. Sage incubated in New Jersey at Rutgers University Center for Ceramic Research. Sage moved to Minnesota in 1999 because our founder, John Van Dyne, identified Minnesota as the Silicon Valley of the window industry. The companies who developed and commercialized today's energy-saving Low-E glass were headquartered here or in bordering states. Sage operated a pilot line in Minnesota from 1999 to 2004. The purpose of that was to get the technology out of the lab and figure out how to actually produce it on a factory floor. In 2003, Sage is one of the first companies to sign on to the original Job Z. With Job Z, Sage was able to attract the private investment necessary to accelerate our transformation from a research company into a high-tech manufacturing company. Job Z helped accelerate job growth and job creation. It also helped accelerate deliveries of this energy-saving technology. In 2003, we started the year with 23 employees. Our Job Z commitment was 20 additional jobs, and we not only met that commitment, but with a job offer I sent out to a student who graduates in May from Mankato today, if he accepts, we will have tripled our job commitment as a Job Z. And those jobs are all high-quality, full-time, living-wage jobs with benefits like health care. And honestly, I have one of the best jobs in the state because I got to hire most of those people, and it's a wonderful thing. So we're talking today about mechanisms to accelerate job growth, and I wish I could tell you that, you know, incubating sustainable manufacturing can happen on its own in the private sector. I wish I could tell you that. But that's just not the history. That's the rarity. Most technologies, they just don't survive their long incubation period. If you look at the transistor, the original material technology that created the computer age, 16 years in incubation, 15 years before they shipped the first product out. In Sage's case, we started in 1989. We shipped our first commercial product in 2006, 17 years. And that's the front-end investment on high technology. Most technologies don't survive, and then once they do get out there, scaling the business and attracting the capital to do that in shorter than the span of decades is also very difficult. Sage would not be shipping commercial products today without the help at the national level from Department of Energy, Department of Defense, the Natural Science Foundation. We wouldn't be shipping products without help at the state level from BEAD, from the legislature, from many agencies in Minnesota, and also the investment from the private sector, corporations and individuals who have the vision and decide to park their money for a decade or two before they'd see anything come of it. Programs such as Green Jobs Z lower the capital cost to incubate new business. They lower the risk to success. And when I talk about that, it's very much a survival issue on the sector of the economy that generates most of the new jobs and most of the sustainable jobs. It helps us attract the private investment. And you've heard earlier that Minnesota has a reputation of being a tough business environment. But programs like JobZ dramatically change that and allow us to start incubating technology and attract not just the technology, but the private investment capital to make that happen. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Any questions of Mr. Lostis, Mr. Hayes, or Rep. Tim Downey? And Rep. Tim Downey, you have a tough row to hoe because Representative Winchesky is looking at all our tax rebate program, so to speak, down in the tax committee, but you're on the committee, so.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and I guess the request here is that we'd have a chance to have that full debate in the tax committee by passing this bill out for its consideration there.
Any further questions? If not, then Representative Downey renews his motion that House File 1194 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the tax committee. We can certainly honor your request. Good luck, Mike. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion to bill. Representative, let's see, who do we got next, though? Representative, I think I'm going to take Representative Hayden next. Representative Clark, you don't mind, do you? Representative Hayden, welcome to the committee. And I think, and I don't know how to proceed with this, Representative Hayden, you've got, this is an information-only bill, but you've got parts of this bill kind of spread out all over the place. You must have learned from Representative Kahn. But anyway, this is just an informational hearing for the committee because we don't have a requested possible piece of it and the job training portion of it. I think this is a very good bill, personally, and with that, Representative Hayden, welcome to the committee, and we'll just get on with the bill. And House File 1666, we're not going to be acting on it, but we may see it a little piece of it in the future.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. House File 1666, I guess is what it is, 1666, is a demonstration project for high-risk men that are returning from the prison system. Imagine leaving the prison system with a felony record, limited education, chemical and mental health problems, no place to live, and no one wants to hire you. Where are you likely to end up? Back in prison at a high cost to the state. A number of private nonprofits realized several years ago that the highest risk adults, the highest risk of returning to prison, are participating in these programs, and there was a high rate of failure. For example, providing just job training when housing and treatment are needed fails. The Network for Better Futures is a demonstration project that is designed to provide access to the key basic needs for the high-risk adults. Housing, employment, access to preventative health care, access to chemical and mental health treatment as needed to the community. The Network is based on best practices that takes advantage of existing programs where possible. The Network is now in its second year of operation and is showing great promise. The focus of this discussion today is really jobs. What the Network has done to create job opportunities for essentially an unemployable population. Today I have Gail Lindsay, who's the COO of the Network, Martin Alameen, who's the team leader sitting behind me, and some of the program participants in the Network for a Better Future, and I'm going to allow them to take the rest of my time just to tell you a little bit about what they do.
Welcome to the committee, and gentlemen, just identify yourself for the team.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daryl Lindsay. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Network for Better Futures. I'm joined today by Vincent Britton here at the table, and as Representative Hayden said, a number of the men who are participants in the network with me. What I'd like to do is make a statement as to what we're doing and who we are, and then I'll allow Vincent to give you his own words about how the network has benefited him. All network participants are working full, working full or part-time jobs with private employers in the year 2008. They worked part-time on Better Futures work crews while they were enrolled in the network. The expectation is that all men will work, and we will offer an intensive array of techniques and supports to ensure that this expectation is met. In 2008, about a third of the men were working full-time with private employers, another third were working part-time with private employers, and a third were working typically working for the network as van drivers or on Better Futures Enterprises work crews for an average of 24 hours a week. We try to limit the amount of hours that a man works on a crew so that they can focus on finding full-time work and or complete a job training program or enroll in school. Our men with full or part-time work are employed in a wide range of jobs, such as laborers in warehouses, construction workers, cooks, retail clerks, and telemarketers. Better Futures work crews are employed by several waste recycling businesses and a property management company, a construction company, mostly for demolition and cleanup, and a cleaning equipment for an asphalt company. In 2008, Better Futures was able to generate 30 new jobs in the community. And at this time, I'd like for Vincent Britton to give you his words on his experience with the network.
Mr. Britton, welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself, please.
My name is Vincent Britton. Good afternoon, everyone.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair. I am, I've been with the network for nine months. I was released from prison a year ago, a little bit over a year ago. And this is the longest that I've been able to maintain employment. And I've been working a year. I've been working since I've been released from prison. And as something that I'm proud of because, you know, I understand, it took me a while to understand the importance of work and just to be being responsible and to be to say that I am a man. And you know, I had some doors, you know, slammed in my face, but there was an opportunity with the network that wasn't, you know, wasn't available anywhere else. And I am, I recently made a member in the network, and that's like, you know, things that we strive for as participants, where you get to the point where you pay your full rent, you have your driver's license, you have a savings and checking account, you're paying your fines, your restitution, child support, and I feel proud to say that I've accomplished all of those things that was put before me, and I couldn't have done it without the help of my support group, and that's, you know, all the administration in the network as well as my brothers. You know, I say we're family, but I also have other responsibilities because there's a lot of different guys that comes in, younger guys. I'm a mentor to a lot of the guys, younger guys that comes into the network, as well as a building manager in one of the buildings. It's my duty to maintain the order in the building, and if I see anything that's not the way it's supposed to be, I contact law enforcement or one of the administrators from the network. So I'm just proud to have a responsibility that, you know, someone sees in me that that they can depend on me, and it feels good. And I'm just I'm thankful to have a second chance to do right, because, you know, a lot of us we made bad choices, but we aren't bad people, and I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you very much. Questions Representative Hayden, Mr. Lindsay, or Mr. Britt? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hayden, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was in 2007 when we passed this initially, we put in place a requirement that an independent audit be done, evaluation of the program.
Has that taken place, and can we get access to that at all?
Mr. Lindsay, maybe Representative Hayes can answer that. Go ahead, Mr. Lindsay.
Yes. Thank you, Representative. I'm sorry, I can't hear your name.
Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Yes, we are working to do that independent evaluation. Part of the issue at hand right now is, in order to do an effective independent evaluation, they need 2 years' worth of data to evaluate. So by us getting further appropriations from the legislature, we will be around for 2 years so that they can complete that evaluation.
If I may, Mr. Chair. I want to talk about the independent evaluation, that not only are they looking at the network, but it is also privately funded. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is doing a independent audit and and a thorough examination of the network to see if they have kind of fulfilled what they said that they were going to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Hayden, was that then the Department of Corrections, the commissioner, he sought them out to do the evaluation then, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's my understanding, and Nancy may help us with this, that as part of the process and the appropriation, that was part of the deal that the network made, which was to go out independently and make sure that they had a thorough examination of the work that they were doing to examine their best practices. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is interested in the network and being a national best practice for reentry work throughout the country.
Okay.
Ms. Heller, do you want to just come up for a second and explain to us how there's a few parts and what happened 2 years ago? And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. This will be very quick. Nancy Hilden, Kay Green Benson, and on behalf of the network. Representative Anderson, to really specifically hit your question, there are actually kind of two paths for evaluation that are underway. In the last biennium, $1.6 million was appropriated for this demonstration project. It took roughly a year to get the kind of competitive RFP through the process. The Corrections Department did withhold $50,000 of that appropriation for an internal evaluation, I will call it, done by the Department of Corrections. There was a 10-month review, not a complete year yet, that was done. It's not complete. However, in addition to that, a private foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, has separately now undertaken with John Jay College in New York a thorough evaluation, and that is the one referenced. And so, again, that is the one without any state monies associated, and a much more expansive and thorough and complete evaluation of actually what are the outcomes going to be. The problem right now is that there's only been 1 year of data so far underway, so they can't complete that more thorough evaluation.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name again.
Nancy Hilden.
Ms. Hilden, so does that, so the Robert Wood, that was the, that was not by the Department of Commerce or Department of Corrections?
No. Mr. Chair, no, there are actually two separate paths. Like I said, the Corrections Department withheld $50,000 from the appropriation to undertake an evaluation. So far, because it took quite a long time to go through that process, the evaluation that I've seen so far only included 10 months, not even a complete year. We have a summary of that in brief, that evaluation, which we can provide to you.
And will you be doing further evaluation then?
Indeed. That is what the Robert Wood Johnson, the more complete, comprehensive evaluation will undertake.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hayden. Nancy.
Ms. Hilden.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Or the author, Jeff. Either one. This program has some of the components of Twin Cities RISE plus Hired in them. And can you tell me where they differ from you? I know they all three seem to be very good in the programs, and I'm sure the needs are very great. But could you tell me what?
Maybe Mr. Lindsay can answer.
Whoever.
The best. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Yes, the various programs are very similar. The difference is this. the men typically who enter the network, quite frankly, are not prepared in many cases to enter and rise as core programmers, that they do not meet those minimal entry-level requirements. So we're working with them to get them there. At the same time, I believe that both Emerge and the network try to assist these same men in reference to trying to get them employment. The difference there is that where Emerge simply works with one component, and that's the employment, the network works not only with employment, but also with housing, complete medical health, behavioral health, and community reengagement. It's a much more holistic approach by the network.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Clark, and then
Anderson. I'm just a little surprised that the evaluation that isn't complete, that wasn't for a whole year, is a $50,000 bill at the Department of Corrections. I don't know who can answer that, but it just seems pretty high for an incomplete evaluation, and I'm just wondering if that's kind of standard pricing or pretty high.
Clark, maybe you can represent. Ms. Hillman, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think in defense of that effort, like I said, it took almost a year to really get this program up and running, and so to even get the report started, the data had to be collected, and so I think that that will be more complete soon, but that's all I can tell you at this point.
I just don't want to waste any money.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Hilden, if you could come back. You know, I'm looking at the language right here, and it was very specific that the independent evaluator be selected by the Commissioner of Corrections. And my concern here is we're not following what the letter of the law is, and we spent $50,000, and we aren't doing what was outlined in the statute.
Ms. Hilden.
Mr. Chair, all I can say is we look forward to the final full data as well. And we have a draft, what I would call the draft, that is the 10-month information.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hilden, it was my understanding that the Department of Corrections did not choose this evaluator, which then how does that even qualify as being independent?
Ms. Hilden, do you want to explain this?
There are two separate evaluations.
Yes, you've gone over that. I understand that we paid $50,000 for a 10-month evaluation, but you guys are going to be basing your evaluation off of the Robert
Ward. Anderson, I think the Department of Corrections took $50,000 for their evaluation, and that the money they got from the Robert Wood Johnson is a contribution, right?
Correct.
And they're the ones that are going to be evaluating.
There are two separate evaluations of the state appropriation, $50,000.
Okay.
The Corrections Department is doing its evaluation. That is still forthcoming with not yet a full year of information. Separate completely from that is a independent evaluation, so no parties involved, the state not involved, us not involved, the network not involved, and that needs to have 2 years. That's the bottom line from John Jay College. They're saying they need to have 2 years. They can't give outcomes until they have enough information.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hayden, how many people have been served with this program? You know, the investment was $1.6 million. How many people have been served, and both genders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I'm going to let the folks from the network answer that. I will say, though, on the gender issue is that the demonstration project looked at high-risk males, in particular high-risk African-American males, because they were the folks that were cycling out, that were recidivating back into the corrections community, if you will. And so they were the highest users. And so this demonstration project, though we hope that as we go further it can serve well all populations, but we thought we'd get the highest impact in looking at this particular population of men that were going in and out of the correction system.
Mr. Lindsay, do you have a number for us on what you served?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In 2008, the network served 224 men. I do not have the number from
the beginning of this year to date, but that total would be well over 250 men to date that the network has served. We retain at this time 120 men still active with the network in our housing and working on our workforce or in some way involved with the network.
Okay, any further questions? If not, I want to thank all of you for coming and thank the gentleman in the back of the room for coming too. Anybody else want to say anything back there? No? Okay, thank you all for coming. Good luck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark. Representative Stanford's been sitting here. Yeah, Representative Stanford. Come on up. And Representative Murphy, would you move House Bill 2006, please? Be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Thank you, Representative, very much, Representative Murphy. Representative Champion, House Bill 2006.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. And I'm excited that you have carved out some time to tell with us a little about my bill. And this is a pretty simple bill, Mr. Chair, if I might put it this way. And when you think in terms of construction season, as we are fastly approaching it, sometimes we don't think about the number of businesses that are affected by construction, be it road construction or something done by next council. But there was an initiative that was put forth about a year or so ago, and the chief author was Senator Patricia Torres-Wright. And they asked MnDOT and some other key stakeholders to take a look at this problem and how construction is affecting small businesses. Now, we're in this notion and this time now where lots of folks are looking at, you know, a stimulus package. How do we make sure that we do job creation? But what we did learn is that there's a lot of job loss as a result of construction work that goes on because lots of businesses have been affected. Now, you may ask, without verbally asking, well, how do I know this? Well, there's a study that I'm holding up. It's called Mitigation of Transportation Construction Impacts, which was done by the state of Minnesota. And it was a report to inform the legislature around this critical question, which is how do we help mitigate construction or the impact on business. And so that's what we have here as a bill identified as 2006. The first part of the bill just talks about the purpose. The second part is it just talks about the establishment of this notion that the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development shall develop and implement a construction mitigation grant program. And this bill, I might add, also follows the recommendations articulated in the Mitigation of Transportation Construction Impact Report. And you also see the definition. Probably the biggest notions here that most people ask a lot about is, one, a business liaison. We're asking for a project or road authority to anticipate repairs or that they're going to make on roads and for them to establish and identify a business liaison, which is outlined in Section 3, Subdivision 2. And that liaison would work with the businesses by which to, you know, talk about the impact.
President Champion, I understand you have an amendment, too, that addresses that business liaison. Do you want to have that moved as well?
Yes, I would like to someone move the A3 amendment.
Yes, Representative Murphy, would you also move the amendment, the A3 amendment? Okay, all right, thank you. yes, this is the, we'll move amend the bill in the fashion that you want it to be, put in the shape you want it. Any questions about the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment is approved. Do you want to speak to the amendment?
Yes. The amendment, what it does is, from the last committee that we were in with the transportation, finance, MnDOT wanted to make sure that there was some change language. And we made those necessary changes particularly around signage and the business liaison, that they were really concerned that they didn't want, if there was going to be construction or some sort of business disruption to a business for like 3 days, they didn't want there to have to be this, you know, business liaison to go out and talk to the business and others around that before it could be for grander impediments such as 30 days. And so that's what this business notion or the change was. And so for a minimum of a period of 1 month, that's what you see in the impacts of business under the definition section, which is subdivision one. That's where you will see substantial business impact. So if there's going to be a substantial business impact of more than a month upon a business, then that's when this process of a liaison would go and talk to the businesses and come up with a plan to maintain visibility. And that's pretty much what the bill is about. I have a small business owner who can, you know, briefly testify to his experience and why this legislation is so important.
Okay, well, then we have a question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Please identify yourself for that.
Yes, my name is Manny Gonzalez, and just to make a story short, I own three restaurants on Lake Street, and the impact of the reconstruction that has in my restaurants has been huge. One restaurant is located on Lake and Bloomington at the Mercado Central. The other one is in the old Sears building, Midtown Global Market. And the other one is on Lake and 27. At the beginning of the construction, my sales went down 30% average. But it was one restaurant and it was a huge impact. And I had to close it a month ago. Because in that restaurant, the construction went for 4 years. But in that particular restaurant, the Lake and 27, the construction went for a year and a half, and in front of my restaurant, it was a huge hole than area wave, I think that's what it is, and it was there for 6 months, and nobody was doing anything. And I remember I told the owner of the building, should I put some water to make an ice skate ring or something? You know, it was in the winter too, you know. So the construction impacted that restaurant really, really bad because, you know, with the economic situation that started last year, I just couldn't, you know, keep it open and I had to close. The other two locations, thanks to the Latino community and the Mercado Central, I was be able to maintain that restaurant. And that Mercado Central has been for 10 years. This year is 10 years anniversary. And, you know, I was able to keep going with the new location at the global market. So I can tell you that the construction is really going to affect a small business if they don't have a financial cushion or something to help them out. During that time, the area in Lake and 27, about 20 businesses went down. And now, of course, the avenue looks really pretty and beautiful, but there are empty spaces. So I really appreciate if you guys can pass this bill because it's going to help a lot of small business. And hopefully you come and eat my sandwich there the best.
I hear you have very good food. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple of quick questions. I wondered if you had, and I'm just missing it here, mitigate the impact of transportation construction. I mean, I listened to your story, and it's tragic that we have businesses. And I've seen it in my own community when, you know, you have a major highway construction and businesses are basically cut off for 2, 3, 4 years. The impact is really tough, particularly in the smaller businesses. But I guess I'm wondering, to mitigate the impact, if the impact is lack of funds and to pay employees, is that what this money is going to be used for, to keep employees? If there aren't any customers, then you're keeping a business open by just giving money. If you could help me with that, and then I've got two other questions.
Ms. Giff, Representative, this notion is not around paying employees or employers for employees, but it's around making sure that we can think through with the business liaison access points, visibility. How do we make sure that we are minimizing the impact on a business? How do we think through and make sure people know how to get into a business? You know, when construction is going on. And so the whole notion of having, first of all, a business liaison who's helping businesses think about that so we can minimize those impacts, then we can be very intentional about strategies that we will use by which to make sure that they are not as affected as they ordinarily would be. And this would also provide an opportunity for the business liaison and the businesses to work with local municipalities so that all great minds are at the table and figuring out what needs to happen so that we can find ways to make the businesses stay, employees and customers can get there, therefore employees will be necessary and it just flows from there.
And if I could
follow up.
Yes, I do. Thank you. I've got a couple. And it kind of gets that point because I did see the portion about signage, and I know that was one of the issues that we had in our community is we needed signs to direct people to different areas so that they knew the business was still open and how to get to it, which is very important. And I guess one of the questions I would have for Deed, and I think they may have left the room unless there's somebody here that can speak for them, have over all the years of the history of construction in the state of Minnesota, has anything like this been done before? I can't believe we haven't had businesses being affected, and perhaps it's risen to a higher level right now given the stimulus package and the increased boost we gave to transportation and funding over the last couple of years. But I guess I was wondering if there's any history that you're aware of, Representative Champion, without the being here, if you have that answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for such a question. It's my understanding that they tried to do something on a ad hoc basis or piecemeal basis, but that was one of the challenges that they identified when they did the research for this report, is that there was no intentional strategy put forward by the state in order to help make sure that businesses can be saved by making sure that there's involvement and there's some intentionality around signage and making sure customers can get there. And so this bill really follows the report. So there is clearly a problem, and we hope that this will help, you know, those small businesses.
And if I could just ask my last little thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're not, well, we are a finance committee, but there's no dollars, and there hasn't been on many of the bills that come forward here. And I guess I wondered if you have talked to anyone about what, because it says the ARRA funds come first, but if they are not available or appropriate, that general fund dollars would come in. Do you have any sort of ballpark? Have you had any thoughts about that?
I have a ballpark.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there are some ballpark numbers that were put forward that were preliminary because the departments were not very clear or sure what was going to happen. You know, some identified $50,000 a year, some identified, you know, a little over $500,000 a year in order to make sure that this is done adequately. But since that time, I've also have talked with the chief author on the Senate side. There's some discussion with the departments around it being a pilot, a smaller notion. And so that's one of the clarifying notions that we will bring forward as this bill, you know, sits and it's considered to be a part of your omnibus bill.
President Clark, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, I was actually just going to build a little bit on Representative Norton's question. I mean, this, and what I really like about Representative Champion's bill is that this is going to do some systemic planning for the future, too. I mean, we've been dealing with this for many, many, many years. I remember when they were doing 394, just the people coming in crying about the loss of their businesses that they had for, you know, family generations. And I can say along Lake Street, my own district, we lost lots of small businesses. And Manny's Produce is the best, I have to say. I'm glad two of his restaurants have survived, but having lost one is terrible. And there are many small businesses in these communities that really suffer. So I'm really glad this bill is before us because I think it does bring it right up to the top in terms of getting some federal funding and hopefully some state funding if that's not forthcoming. But I would guess it would be very, very applicable to the stimulus bill.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Champion, thank you for bringing this to our attention. It's been around, this problem, for years. I had a roommate who owned a lot of Dairy Queens, And he had one of them that was completely cut off by a highway change, Ryan Krause. And they paid him, DOT paid him for the cost, estimated cost of that Dairy Queen. And I'm surprised that they isn't part of the cost analysis of every transportation project, that they don't have this automatically figured out. And I don't know if this funding should come from this committee. I really believe your first stop was appropriate stop, because it should be a change in the law if it's not that way already. The Department of Transportation, when they design a project, should take that in consideration. And the protection, not only the employer and his investment, but also the employee's livelihood. And I really do thank you for bringing this to our attention. I hope someone does the right thing somewhere. I don't think it's in the purview of this committee, because we pay unemployment, but that shouldn't be the answer. The answer should be the Department of Transportation has a mediation deal, just like you're outlining, to take care of the needs of this gentleman here when there are transportation projects that cut more than 30% of his business out. I think it's unconscionable if they don't, and thank you again for bringing this to our attention.
Representative Eastland?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came kind of late on the discussion here, but I don't think there's any question that this is an issue that's a lot of different areas of concern. My question is that does putting this kind of thing in statute create any implied liabilities here that we're going to be dealing with? Go ahead.
Chair,
Representative, it's my understanding that it doesn't create any implied liability. The only thing this is doing is making sure that all heads are thinking in concert with each other as to how do we mitigate the construction impact on small businesses. That's it. And we can do it from a number of different perspectives. You know, signage, access points, all those sort of things, you know. And also to empower small businesses as well, so small businesses can speak into this question as well, because they are the ones who are most affected. As so eloquently articulated by the representative before you asked the question, they end up, if these things are not addressed in real time, they end up, you know, losing customers and their business tanking and losing employees and losing their life investment. So I don't think that there's any implied liability other than, you know, any of the insurances that you have to have under any other circumstance by you inviting the public in. So I don't think there's any increased liability for the business owner.
You have a follow-up?
Yeah, a follow-up. I guess what I'm thinking of is, you know, there's clearly, as Representative Gunther said, I mean, if a business shuts down or loses all their customers, there's clearly a loss, and it's pretty easy to measure. Oftentimes, my experience in improvements along roads is that the improved roads also leaves a significant business advantage after it's done. And I guess I think there's kind of two sides to this issue. There's a cost of making the improvement. There's a benefit of having the improvement. And it would seem like it's kind of a difficult thing to measure. And I'm just kind of concerned about the language here, and I haven't looked at it that closely, how tight it is to really address some of those things so that there can't be some after-the-fact claims that are made or something that maybe really have no basis, and yet they're going to be strung into this legislation. But that's just a concern, and I guess I'd just like to have that on the record.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gonzalez, I represent Slocum, was telling me about your good sandwiches that you make and that they're the very best, and I don't imagine you have an answer for this, but I know construction workers eat a lot, and they buy lunches, and so didn't they buy their lunches at your place, or?
No, they didn't. It was really hard to see that, but no, they bring their own lunch. Yeah, there were few, but overall, Yeah, they bring their own lunch.
Well, that should be built in there, that they have to buy lunches from the restaurants that are along the way, I would think.
Representative Hawes. Representative Hawes, question? Did you have a question?
think I did, but I forgot what the question was.
All right. Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 2006 can be laid over for possible inclusion as amended. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Clark, I think you have the last bill of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm really pleased to bring you the Indigenous Earthkeepers program bill today, and I do have a delete all amendment which I'd like to move, Mr. Chairman. It's DEC amendment, DE5 amendment, excuse me.
Okay. Could you move the bill first, and then we'll...
Sure. I'd like to move House File 2071 be recommended to pass, I believe, laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very well.
Mr. Chair, we have the DE4 amendment in our pack, or I do. Okay, then I just don't have the right
one. Do we have the DE5 amendment as well?
Okay. Okay, would you like to move the amendment?
And then, Mr. Chairman, I will move the DE5 amendment.
Okay.
We'll put the bill in the one that I'd like to have it considered today.
All right. President Clark has moved the amendment 2071 DE5 in order to get the bill in the shape that she would like it. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. You know, it's spring break, so usually when I have these kind of youth programs, I like to bring a lot of the youth to for you to meet and actually hear directly from their own words, in their own words, what this bill would mean to them. But they're on break today, and so are the teachers, so I'm going to just try to do the best I can. This is a bill I've been working on for about 3 years with a group of American Indian teachers and leaders at the Niwahi Center School and at the Minneapolis American Indian Center. And we had explored a couple possibilities for how we might fund the kinds of summer youth job training and environmental work program that's indicated in this bill. And in the original bill, had thought maybe we would work through youth build or youth works of conservation corps. And in the end, what was decided is that we will go work with the federal stimulus dollars and whatever there might be from the Workforce Investment Act to go directly to this project. It is a unique project. It's based on American Indian culture and respect for the environment. And what I really like about this program is that it really helps connect a lot of American Indian youth who are in urban areas in particular and have been disconnected from a lot of their cultural connections to the environment. And in discussing this with teachers and so on over the last few years, one of the examples, for example, that has come up is that American Indian respect and appreciation for clean water and the rivers and lakes and so on really brings a lot of these youth. I can bring a lot of these youth out to help be involved in some of the cleanup work that needs to be done there. But also, even just to get in a canoe on the river is not something that some urban American Indian youth have had the opportunity to do in their young lives. So this is the kind of thing that will help connect those folks. The languages, American Indian language, is a core part of what's the curriculum that's being offered here, as well as the reintroduction to the culturally relevant names and ideas about why the rivers and lakes are part of the culture and have been for many, many millennia. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions. I don't have, as I mentioned, the students or teachers here with me today, but this is a project that will hire up to 80 students for a summer program, and I believe it will go for up to 8 weeks for ages 14 to 19. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Okay. Questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Clark renews her motion that House File 2071, as amended, recommended for possible inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
That's a motion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Representative Mahoney, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to use those minutes as written.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. And then I have some announcements here. Next week, Bill, this is the omnibus bill, right? The omnibus bill will be passed out during committee. Quick walkthrough. We'll reconvene on Tuesday for the markup. If necessary, we'll continue the markup Wednesday at 1 o'clock. The bill will be voted out on Thursday. Okay, we have to reconvene that evening. Okay, we'll meet Tuesday at 1 and reconvene that same Tuesday at 7 p.m. Okay? Without further ado, then, we are adjourned.